episode 55 of the Two Chairs Talking podcast. My name is David Grigg, and I'm here today with the ever loquacious Perry Millis. Hi, Perry.
Hello, David. How are you?
Not too bad. Happy winter solstice.
Yes.
Just
yes,
minutes ago, it actually went by, apparently, the actual exact moment of solstice.
As we're recording, as we record. The shortest day of the year for us, longest day for some. But at least the days will get longer from here on in.
And, yes, that'll be good.
It's a pleasantly sunny day today, but cold.
Very cold. I mean, it might, of course, all our Canadian listeners will be laughing if we call this cold, but never mind.
Yes.
It's cold for us.
13 or 14 degrees, that's cold enough, thank you very much. I did spend a few years living in Canberra, and that was freezing, and I'm happy to have got away from that sort of weather. It's not my style very much at all. I'd rather things in the low to mid 20s is perfect. You can do whatever you want.
You're right.
And you don't have to worry about things. But how's everything else in your world, David?
Oh, things have been going on, but I don't really want to go into all that. But yeah, just keeping going the same old way, keeping myself busy.
Same here. There's been a few interesting things happening out in the literary world.
Tell me, Perry.
Our listener may well be interested in hearing about. First off, the Hugo Award packet, the Hugo Award voters packet is now available for members of this year's Worldcon. We've discussed this previously, David. What it entails is a fairly large collection of materials all related to the Hugo Award nominees for this particular year. Where possible, the organisers of this voters packet try to get either the full version or excerpts of all of the fiction pieces. That's the novel, novella, novelette and short story. And this year I believe that they've got all of the three smaller ones, and they've got excerpts of the from the novel,
right,
which is generally the way they pretty much do things. They pretty much get excerpts rather than the full thing, but sometimes you're lucky enough that some of the publishers will say, yes, you can have this. Now, this particular voters packet comes as part of your membership overall package. If you are a supporting or an attending member of this year's Worldcon, you are allowed to vote in the Hugo Awards, and you get the Hugo Award voters packet, and you're allowed to vote in the site selection, that is the choice of the Worldcon for 2 years hence. So that will be in 2023. The main contenders for that are a site in China and Memphis in Tennessee in the US, I believe. There may be one other. I think there might well be, but we'll talk about that a bit later on when we get closer to the mark. Don't really need to worry about that just at this stage. And of course, you get all the written materials that come out from the convention. It helps support the convention to give them money to be able to do what they need to do. And as a member, getting the voters packet is really quite useful.
Yep.
And that will allow me specifically to be able to get through all of the fiction pieces for this year, which I'll gradually work my way through. I think we've been talking about the possibility of discussing the best novellas in a couple of episodes.
Yep.
I just about finished all of them, and I'll ask you to read a couple of them.
Sure.
I won't submit you to the arduous task of going through the whole lot, David.
I think that'd probably be
a bit too much. Just a couple of highlights, I think.
Well, that sounds good.
We have something to talk about, which will be good. A couple of things on the Australian literary field as well. The Miles Franklin Award, which, as you'll know, is the major literary award in Australia.
Yes.
It released its shortlist this week. And interestingly enough, two of the books on that shortlist are from Text Publishing, with covers by a friend of the podcast, W.H. Chong.
Indeed.
So he's there are six shortlisted novels. They are Amnesty by Aravinda Diga, The Rain Heron by Robbie Arnott, which I discussed last year, At the Edge of the Solid World by Daniel Davis Wood, The Labyrinth by Amanda Lowry, Luckies by Andrew P- Pipos and the Inland Sea by Madeline Watts. The Lowry and the Arnott are the two that were published by Text Publishing with covers by Chong. I've read The Rain Heron, and I was lucky enough to pick up a copy of The Labyrinth from the library. Went to the library the other day, and just as an aside, but this is rather, I thought this was rather amusing, I just thought I'd go and have a look and see if it was there, because thinking, it's on the Miles Franklin Award list. There'll be reservations for this, you know, a mile long. I won't be able to, possibility of being able to get it. So I go up to the spot on the Hawthorne Library shelves, and lo and behold, there it is.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a bit lucky, I thought. So I go and take it down, and of course it's all scanning, so you do all the scanning yourself, and ding, 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 the alarm goes off, and I get there, no, this is a missing item. You have to take it to the librarian. I thought,
no, bother.
Missed out. Anyway, so I did all the right thing, got all the rest of my books out, and I thought, oh, I'll take it up there. So I go up there and take it up to him, and said, look, I'll just try to check this out, and it's a missing item. Oh, okay. Where did you find it?
On the shelf.
On the shelf, exactly where it was supposed to be. Oh, okay. Interesting. I said, yes, I don't know why, but there it was. Oh, I'll just go check for you. She goes off and checks it for me. Yes, it is missing. Do you want to borrow it? And I said, well, yes, but I just assume that somebody else has got it reserved. Oh, well, if you were the one that found it, if it would have been lost, sort of as a reward, we allow you to borrow it straight away.
Well done.
So I thought I'd better do the right thing and get onto that one. Mm. So I'll be reading that one next. So just to do the right thing. But that was a bit of a shock. I didn't think that I'd have, snowball's chance in hell of being able
good
to
luck.
Get
Good luck, yeah, very good luck. There,
so
yeah.
So that was just an amusing aside regarding the Miles Franklin Award for me this year. It's probably the only amusing thing I'm going to have for the Miles Franklin Award, enough. But that's all right.
Well, I'll put the list in the show notes, I think. I've got links
all right,
to
I'll
the
send,
books.
I'll send that to you.
Now, I've actually got it already. I took it off a website, yeah.
All right. Now, the other one is the ALS Gold Medal shortlist. Now, the ALS is the Australian Literary Society, and they have been handing out their gold medal, which is for the best book published in the year, not necessarily, I think, of fiction. It can be poetry, it can be short stories, it can play, it can be anything. And so they also have six on their list, and their list is, well, almost completely different, bar one.
Okay.
The first one, The Rain Heron.
Okay, so I'll see
the
comment
again. So it's back again. So that's good to hear. The next one is Cadaver Dog by Luke Best.
Mm.
The Animals in That Country by Laura Jean McKay.
Which
we have talked about. I reviewed that at the same time as I reviewed The Rain Heron by Robbie Arnott last year. The Adversary by Ronnie Scott. Song of the Crocodile by Nadi Simpson. And Throat by Ellen Van Nieuwen. Now, most of those, other than The Rain Heron and The Animals in That Country, I actually don't know anything about. So it will be interesting to have a bit of a look at those.
Mm.
So the Miles Franklin Award and the ALS Gold Medal are two of the top awards for books, fiction, given out in Australia each year. So I thought it was worth our while mentioning those.
Yeah, it'd be worth following up. Certainly a few of those, for sure.
Absolutely.
We might have a Miles Franklin episode.
Well, we might do.
We might have Miles Franklin episode, yeah.
Yeah, well, I recently read last year's winner, The Yield, which I was most interested in. I think I talked about that.
You did,
last week or the week or so back. That was very interesting. I do like to try and read the winner if I can. I'm having to catch up again because I've got so many other books on the to-be-read pile to get through, as we all have. But anyway, we do the best we can.
We do, indeed.
But anyway, David, I think if there's nothing else, we need to talk about pre-program details.
We'll roll in. So this is going to be yet another episode focused on crime. And so we're both of us are going to talk about books in the crime genre. And most of the books I think we're going to talk about are by Australian authors, I think I'm correct in saying.
Anyway, mostly, yeah.
All right, so I'm going to start with a book called The Dragon Man by Gary Disher. Now, this is the first Gary Disher novel I've read, although Perry and Lucy Sussex have long been singing his praises on this podcast. It's still taken me a while to get around to him. So anyway, this is the first one I've read. Now, I should probably, I guess, have started with one of his more recent books, but I'm one of these people who likes to read every book in his series in strict chronological order. Unfortunately, this sometimes means that I take forever to get through a whole series. For example, I've still got to complete my reading of Michael Rowbotham's Joseph O'Loughlin novels. Suffice it to say that I picked up this book from my local library when I saw that it was the first in Gary Dish's Chalice and Destry series, of which there are now seven titles. And these are what's called police procedural mysteries. That is to say, they center around the operations of police detectives investigating crimes, generally using their normal police procedures, usually with a few twists. Now, Perry has talked about how Dish's series set in rural areas, in a rural area of South Australia, resonates with him because that setting is close to the area where Perry grew up. Well, the Chalice and Destry novels have a similar resonance for me, not quite the same strength, but a similar resonance, because they're set on the Mornington Peninsula, which is the long 50 or 60 kilometre curved piece of land southeast of Melbourne, which sits between Port Phillip and Western Port Bays. Now, this is very familiar territory for me because we often used to holiday down there on the peninsula. And once they retired, my parents moved down there, and they lived in several different locations down there, including in the town of Hastings, which seems to be the place on which Disher has based his fictional town of Waterloo. And we've also got good friends who live in the area. So it's Mornington Peninsula is a pretty familiar region of the world for me. So it's good to read books which are set in areas that you know pretty well. So this novel, The Dragon Man, starts with the abduction of a young woman late one night from a location along the Old Peninsula Highway. It's the Old Peninsula Highway because there's now a new modern freeway down the length of the peninsula. And we're introduced to Detective Inspector Hal Chalice. A senior homicide investigator for the area. It seems he goes wherever he's most needed. He goes to different areas as there's a need. So when this abduction is reported, he's pulled in by the Waterloo CIB, Criminal Investigation Branch. Apparently there was a previous similar abduction from the old highway just the previous week, and the young woman in that incident has since been found, raped and murdered. And we're also introduced to Ellen Destry, who's the sergeant in charge of Waterloo CIB, who will work with Chalice on the case. Naturally, as in all these kinds of novels, we discover that Chalice has a backstory which influences his current behaviour to some degree. He keeps getting desperate calls from his ex-wife, and we eventually learn that she's actually in prison. She's in prison because she was having an affair and tried to get her lover, another policeman, to kill off Hal Chalice. Now, Ellen Destry, the other major character, is married, and she's the mother of a teenage daughter who she's worried may be getting into drugs. She's also very disenchanted with her husband, and she's open to other romantic interests. One of these interests, though, leads her into difficulties in the novel. So Chalice and Destry interview a local sex offender who seems to have reasonable alibis for the times of these abductions, but his alibis are not really rock solid, and so their attention remains on him for quite a while. Meanwhile, a couple of young yobbos are having fun roaming the area at night and setting fire to letterboxes. And they're also involved in a number of burglaries in the region. And their activities turn out to trigger a number of consequences which affect the course of the whole story. One of the letterboxes they set alight is that of a woman who has moved to Australia from New Zealand as part of a witness protection program, having been involved in the drug scene there. And when her letterbox goes up in flames, she's terrified, thinking that her criminal associates in New Zealand have tracked her down. And the policeman who responds to her call slowly gets pulled into a sexual relationship with this woman and starts to raid the evidence locker for drugs to feed the woman's continuing drug habit. At the same time, one of the burglaries carried out by the couple of young guys turns out to yield vital evidence which leads Chalice and Destry to solving the mystery of the abductions. And it's all cleverly done. I did think that the title of the book was a bit weak, The Dragon Man. It's called that because Chalice's main interest when he's not at work is restoring old aeroplanes, in particular a 1930s de Havilland Dragon Rapide, which is a large biplane, which he's putting into working order at the local aero club. Hence he gets called the Dragon Man by the other club members there. But other than that, this title and his hobby really don't seem to have much to do with the rest of the book, so I wasn't quite sure why he used that title. Nevertheless, with that quibble aside, I thought the book was pretty good. I'll probably persevere with reading the other books in this particular series, but it wasn't as good as another book by Gary Disher in a different series, which I'll talk about in a little while.
I've always liked those novels. I like, as you've mentioned at the start, I do like Disher's work. I think he was starting out with his police procedures, which sort of he finishes off because I don't think he knew what else to do with the Mornington Peninsula, or at least he felt as though he had covered as much as he could. And then he starts off on the other series that you're going to talk about in a little while. And I think, though, that these books do get better and better as they go along. The first couple are him trying to find his feet in this particular genre and in this particular locale. And once he does, things start coming together very, very nicely. And
well, I guess that's the problem I have of always wanting to read things in chronological order. You know, you do necessarily start out with the earlier books written by an author who perhaps hasn't quite gotten into stride with that particular thing.
Yeah, but it also helps then you to set the background for it.
It does.
Doesn't
I think
so
you
know
need to,
you know where things are coming from. You know what the author's doing with the character right from the very beginning.
Yep.
Instead of jumping in, because sometimes they'll refer back to previous events that happened in that particular character's life, as you normally would expect that a character
sure.
would do, regardless of whether they're in a novel or not. And so everyone, character's got a history. And if you have some of that history leading in, it fleshes out the character the longer and longer the series goes.
Yeah.
Him to run it to about 7, I thought was pretty good. I wouldn't have been surprised if he'd done a couple more. But I think he's found another outlet for
yeah.
what he wants to have a look at. So,
sure.
But I would recommend reading anything by Disher. I think it's wonderful stuff. After you get through all these, I'll get you back onto the reading through the Wyatt books.
Yeah, they look interesting.
You see what you think of those. Again, they start off light-ish and gradually form much more of a character as he gets further and further into the series, because he has to do more and more with it. He can't just keep on running the old plot over and over again, and he has to basically, you know, sort of just keep on fleshing it out. And it works out really well.
Good.
I'm also reviewing an Australian crime novel. Mine's called The Wife and the Widow by Christian White. This was the winner of the 2020 Ned Kelly Award for Best Novel. Now, the Ned Kelly Awards, as you may know, David, are run by the Crime Writers of Australia and are there to represent the best novel and debut novel and best non-fiction in the film of crime writing in Australia. So it's a fairly prestigious award. And he won this... Christian White won the 2020 Ned Kelly Award for his second novel, The Wife and the Widow, and he ran it against some reasonably strong opposition. Nick Gad, Dervla McTiernan was up for this one with The Scholar. We've discussed that particular book. Dave Warner. Now, I don't know whether you've read anything by Dave Warner, David, but
no.
I don't know whether you remember a band from Western Australia called Dave Warner in the from the suburbs, was it? He's an ex-musician now turned crime writer, and he's written some very, very interesting books. And I believe that he won a Ned Kelly Award a few years back
okay.
as well for one set in Broome, just as a cyclone was about to hit.
Yeah.
And also David Wish Wilson, who's another West Australian author, he was up for this particular award as well. So strong field, because, of course, we're always talking now about there being very strong crime writing appearing in Australia. Now, this is, you were talking about the Mornington Peninsula with the previous book. This one's on the other side of Port Phillip Bay, and it's set mainly on the fictional Victorian island of Bellport, which is situated a short ferry ride off the coast of the Bellarine Peninsula.
Yeah.
Now, this follows two main threads, as you can probably guess from the title, The Wife and the Widow. The widow is Kate Keddie, and the wife is Abby Gilpin. Now, as soon as you start reading this, he basically does his interlaces his chapters with one called The Wife and one called The Widow. He starts off with The Widow with Kate Keddy, who's standing at the international arrivals area of Tullamarine Airport waiting for her husband to appear. But she's the widow, you think, what's going on here? So he's sort of having to, he's giving you a hint about what's going to be happening coming up with this. So anyway, she's standing there at Tullamarine Airport waiting for her husband John to return from a London medical conference. He's been away for a couple of weeks and he's been contacting them every night via Skype. This was written in 2019, pre-Zoom popularity days. So Zoom's not mentioned. It's all Skype in those days. You've been there, David. You know, you're basically, you can't see the passengers coming through. They suddenly appear and they turn either way and head down and everybody goes, oh, hello, there you are. So all the passengers wander out in dribs and drabs until there's nobody left. Mm-hmm. And her husband doesn't appear. Ah, not sure what's going on. So she tries to contact him, tries to contact the hotel. Well, he was never here. Doesn't know what's going on. So she goes to goes to his workplace, place of work, and he rings. She wanders down there to see somebody, and the first person doesn't want to talk to her. Okay, so she wanders around a bit and finds somebody else, and that person says, well, look, I'll put you on to somebody else. And she thinks, what's going on? I'm getting fobbed around here all over the place. She finally gets to speak to somebody, and the woman that she speaks to says, I don't know what you're after. Well, where's my husband? I don't know. He hasn't worked here for 3 months. Oh. So there's secrets. Somehow or other, the husband has told her that he's gone to this medical told her that he has gone to this medical conference in London, and he has not gone. She has no idea where she is. She basically goes to see the husband's father, who's a bit of an overbearing pain in the ass at the beginning of the book, but basically settles down after a little while. And while she's basically there, she gets a call from the from a security company saying that her holiday home, or the alarm on her holiday home on Belport Island, has been triggered. Oh, he must have gone there, she thinks. That's where he is. He's gone down there. I'll go down there and see him. So she and the father head off down there. The other thread for this particular book is set solely on Belport Island. Abby's husband, Ray, runs a handyman business on the island, maintaining the holiday homes during the off-season, doing repairs that need to be done, lawn mowing, anything, odd jobs around the place. But he has ongoing contracts with particular holiday homes. So you think, maybe he's actually snuck in there and not turned the alarm off or something along those lines. So you start to see there's some connections going on here. Anyway, Abby's basically doing some work one day in the garage and drops something down underneath a desk. And as she goes down to have a look at it, she has to reach behind this sort of table there where she's dropped something that she's been working with, and finds a box hidden down the back, stuffed in the back of behind this particular table, behind something, and opens it up and finds out that it's a stash of gay porn.
Mm.
And she thinks, oh, must belong to her husband. Not sure what is going on there. At the same time, there's a dead body that's been found on the island. You think, ah, okay, so this is the dead body that we've got. And various things go on and happen over the next couple of chapters, where it obviously becomes to the view where Abby starts suspecting her husband of having committed this murder. He seems to be there in the right place in the right time. And that's all I can tell you about this particular book, David. I can't go on to this book any particular further, because there is a very, very major twist at the end of this book that if I give you even a hint of it, and I've had to be very, very careful about what I've said for this, there's a very major twist that if I give you even a hint of it, it will ruin the whole book completely.
Oh, well, then I've got to go read the book. Mm.
I think you have to go read this book. I'll lend it to you. So about two-thirds of the way through, I started to You know, every now and again, it crops up in a crime novel. You think, what the heck's that going on about? What's it? I actually thought the author had lost control and had made a mistake. And I thought that the plot had just gone just awry. It didn't make any sense. Some things were coming up that didn't gel with other things that had been there before. And I thought they'd completely messed it up. But by the end of the novel, everything is rounded off. You figure out what's going on. You work out how everything connects with everything else. And it is really quite a very, very well-written book, this one. It hides its major twist for 200, 250 pages out of the 300. And you only get the bit at the end and then it's, oh, that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those revelationary things that you get. And you think, oh, this guy's done a really, really good job. Mm. Now, I thought this was certainly worth winning the Ned Kelly Award. And it's certainly worth any reader's time to read this particular book. I gave it 4.3 out of 5. Mm. Could have given it 4.4, but I've been giving a lot of books 4.4 lately. And I thought, maybe just a bit less than that. But it's pretty damn good. It's right up there with some of the best recent Australian crime novels. And
yeah, it does sound good.
Certainly, you come out of it and you think, oh, he did that really well. So I'd recommend
good.
This one.
Yeah, it does sound very good. All right. Well, my next one is yet another novel by Gary Disher. This one's called Bitter Wash Road. Now, Perry's already talked on the podcast about this series of books, but I don't think he went into too much detail about this, which is the first one in the series, Bitter Wash Road, which was published in 2013. In any case, I'll try not to repeat too much of what Perry's already said about it. So, and I'm going to let Perry correct me here because I'm going to talk about this region of the world. So, as I mentioned earlier, this is set in a rural area of South Australia, about 3 hours drive north of Adelaide, and it's somewhat south of the Flinders Ranges. And Perry knows the area well because that's where he grew up. And it looks from his biography on Goodreads anyway that this is also where Gary Disher himself grew up. Is that right?
Yeah, somewhere around the town of Burra, which is just to the north of the Barossa Valley. So I wouldn't say 3 hours north, maybe two, but that's quibbling. You know, when I grew up and I was living in the small country town that I grew up in, it used to take close to 3 hours to get there by car. And then by the time when they fixed up a number of bits and pieces of the road, cars got better, it was down to about 2 hours. So, yeah, so there you go.
Yeah, okay. Now, I've been there, but I've only just driven through it as a tourist a couple of times on my way to the Flinders Ranges, I guess. Now, as I understand it, it's a farming area, but it's one very dependent on regularly getting decent rain, something which is definitely not assured. And there are many old abandoned buildings around the area which are a testament to past droughts when farmers just gave up and walked off the land. Now, the protagonist of these novels is a constable, Paul Hirschhausen, generally just called Hirsch. And as the novel opens, Hirsch has recently been posted to the one-man police station in the small town of Tiverton, I should say. He does talk about this business about it being one man because, it should be one person perhaps, but they don't post women to these positions for all sorts of reasons. Anyway, he's been posted there from Adelaide essentially as a punishment for blowing the whistle on a group of corrupt police officers in a suburban station in Adelaide. And the senior police there really were corrupt. They were getting kickbacks from criminals. They were dealing in drugs, a whole range of things. All of this was under the control of Senior Sergeant Marcus Quine, who was the head of the criminal investigation branch at the station, who eventually gets charged, has been charged and is now out on bail awaiting trial. But nevertheless, Hirsch has broken the unwritten rule among police that you don't dob in another police officer. And so he's very much on the nose with most of the other police people. And Hirsch hasn't really been able to shake off the suspicion among some people, even his own parents, that he himself had been involved in the corrupt activity before maybe he just blew the whistle because he wasn't getting a big enough cut. But in fact, he is actually an honest cop. But he's dispatched to Tiverton, where he comes under the supervision of a Sergeant Cropp, who runs the station in the nearby town of Redruth, which is a bit larger than Tiverton. And Cropp and the two constables there consider Hirsch to be a dog and a maggot because of his whistleblowing in Adelaide, and they treat him with contempt. And Hirsch is constantly aware of the malevolence towards him of many in the police force, and the fact that those close to the corrupt officers in Adelaide still want to bring him down. But he just tries to keep his head down and get on with his job, such as it is. There's not a lot of crime in a small town like this. But he obsessively documents everything he does, making sure that he covers his back. Now, early on in the story, Hirsch is dispatched by Sergeant Kropp to investigate the report of a body of a woman lying near the side of a rural highway. And that turns out to be the case, and a local doctor turns up to confirm that the woman is dead. And her injuries indicate that she's been struck and perhaps run over by a car. And because she's been his patient previously, the doctor immediately identifies the body as Melia Donovan, a 16-year-old girl from Tiverton. Was it just an accident? What was she doing on foot so far from her home? Why didn't the driver stop after the impact? Was she murdered? As Hirsch investigates, the story becomes more and more complicated and leads us into some very murky areas. And all this time, Hirsch is struggling against the indifference and hostility of the local police, including the local police superintendent, even the local magistrate, dead set against him. Along the way, Hirsch discovers a plan by the associates of Marcus Quine, who is the corrupt officer in Adelaide, to convict Hirsch of corruption by planting evidence in his car, a phone and a heap of cash taken from an evidence locker. And the idea is to discredit him before Quine's trial, but Hirsch is able to cleverly turn the tables on them. And there's another thread of the story which comes in about halfway through the book, the apparent suicide by shooting of Alison Latimer, who was a local woman who was about to divorce her husband. Hirsch has strong suspicions about this death, despite the strong alibis of Alison's husband and her father-in-law, who had most to gain from her death. But his efforts to secure the scene and collect evidence are defeated by the clumsy or perhaps deliberate intervention of the other police from Redruth. It's too hard to summarize the whole book. These plots of crime novels tend to get too complicated generally to summarize in any detail. But suffice it to say that Hirsch is eventually able to find out what happened to young Melia Donovan and to Alison Latimer and to bring justice home to those who were involved. There's a clever twist right at the end, though, which I really liked, which I won't give away, but it does reveal that Hirsch wasn't quite as good a policeman as he thought he was. Look, I like this a lot. Paul Hirschhausen is a strong, well-drawn character. The background and situation are really interesting and convincing. And the plot of the novel pulls you in quickly and makes you want to keep on reading. I mean, I read this in 2 days. So this is so far the only one of the series which I've read, but I'm really looking forward to reading the other two novels in the series, which are Peace, which was published in 2019, and Dish's most recent novel, Consolation, published last year in 2020. So yeah, I'm going to be following up on Gary Disher a fair bit.
I can't say anything more than you said and what we said in the past. I think that he's one of the best of the crime writers around at the moment in Australia. He's at the top of his form. Hopefully he keeps on going. I saw him at a function recently, and even though he's a bit older than I am, he looks a hell of a lot better than I do, I can tell you that. So he must be leading a very good life, I think, David. And
yes. He must be about 72, judging from the biography on Goodreads.
Yeah, I think so. Early, mid-70s, I think, yeah. Yes. And so he's looking quite fit, which augurs well for more volumes in the future. And I think I do believe there is another novel coming out from him later this year. Chong was telling me that here at the text publishing have another one of his coming up, but I asked him about it and he wouldn't tell me.
Fair enough.
All he can do is say that yes, there is one, and that's all you're getting. Okay, which is good. So I just look forward to anything that he writes. I'm quite happy to read anything that he comes up with, because I know that it's going to be well crafted. It's going to be an interesting story. The characters are going to be great, and he deals with his crime novels uses locale and locations to great effect.
Yeah, he does. Yeah,
you know, Bitterwash Road lives and breathes the area in which it's set.
Yeah, it does. It really has that feeling of place. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And it's an area that's referred to as the margins of the good earth. In South Australia, that basically climate change is affecting it fairly badly, and those margins where you're going to get there's a particular line that a surveyor back in the 1800s drew through parts of South Australia regarding places to the north, you would get more bad years than good years. Places to the south, you get more good years than bad. That line is gradually moving further and further south. And I would have thought that it was well below where I grew up and getting pretty close to where Disher has set these novels. So it's when it's dry there, it is really dry, really, really dry. Anyway, let's move away from Australia utterly and completely and go to the US with the novel that I'm going to be dealing with, which is Stephen King's latest novel.
Yeah.
Now, you may say, David, Stephen King, he doesn't write crime novels.
Oh,
he does, actually.
He does, yeah.
Well, you won't say it. I just put the words into your mouth, but there you go. So this is the third novel that Stephen King has written for the publisher's Hard Case Crime, following The Colorado Kid in 2006 and Joyland in 2013. This book later was published earlier this year, and so it's the third of his that he's done with this particular publishing house. Now, Hard Case Crime is an interesting little outfit. It's a small US publishing house founded in 2004, and it's dedicated to publishing paperbacks with the form and content of those noirish pulp novels of the 1950s and 1960s, same sort of covers, same sort of stories. They've published works by authors such as Lawrence Block, Earl Stanley Gardner, Donald E. Westlake, Cornell Woolrich, David Goodis and Egg McMahon, some major crime novelists. And sometimes they publish some of the earlier works for these particular writers. They've also released crime novels by well-known science fiction writers like Robert Block, Harlan Ellison, Robert Silverberg and Roger Zelazny. Mm-hmm. So sometimes these guys wrote these books that either got a small printing, didn't really do very well, or were just put into a drawer and not enough. These guys have picked them up. They all have a sort of standard format in terms of size and spine printing, so they're easy to find. And then now I notice with this particular one, they're being printed and published in Australia using the Griffin Press printers. They're all pretty much well worth tracking down. If you like crime novels of this particular ilk, these are really good ones to have a look at. Now, Later is essentially a crime novel, but of course it's a Stephen King novel, so you've got to have some supernatural element to it, as you might expect. Now, in this one, the narrator, Jamie Conklin, has been born with the gift of being able to see dead people. Yes, this is very much like The Sixth Sense with Bruce Willis. And even that particular film is referenced very early on in the book. Now, Jamie Conklin says that at one point that he lives a life like a Charles Dickens novel, but with more swearing, which I thought was a good line from King. And anyway, Jamie Conklin discovers that he can see dead people and that he sees them soon after they have died. And regardless of how bad or mean they may have been in their real life, when they are actually dead, they're a little bit more pleasant and cannot tell any lies. Now, they don't necessarily have to tell you to give you an answer. If they can avoid it, they will say, I don't want to tell you that. But they can't tell you a lie when they actually get to the point of starting to tell you what the answer is. And that point is very major to this particular novel. Jamie's single mother works for, she's a literary agent and she makes use of her son's unusual talents when the major author for the publishing house, the one that she earns most of their commissions from, drops dead in the middle of writing his very last novel. So there's about 30 or 40 pages to go in this particular book, but it's still in first draft. And she picks up the kid and takes her friend, partner, lover, Liz, who's an ex-cop, with them, and they go to the writer's place, go to his writer's shed, and he's sitting there, and Jamie interviews him, tells the mother all the information about what's in the book, and then goes off and writes it. Because lo and behold, what's been happening is that although she's a literary agent, she's been doing most of the copy editing for the books over the past eight or nine of them, wherever many there are, to get them to a position where they're actually publishable, because they're really quite thin or racy, and basically they need a lot. They need a lot of work, David. They just need a lot of work. Now, that's one of the major funny parts of this particular thing. But later on in the book, Liz, who has now split up with Jamie's mother, is on the outer at with the police, and she's actually been done for running drugs and shifting drugs around from point A to point B. And of course, while you're there, you might as well try do a bit of sampling. So she's an addict, and she's trying to make a really big score. So she actually, at the end of the book, kidnaps Jamie and takes him off to a dead drug lord's house to try to interview him after he's died to work out where he's put all of his major stash. So this is an interesting variant on the seeing dead people trope, if you want to call it that, because I don't know what else to call this sort of thing. But it doesn't really have the absolute sparkle of King's best work. I mean, it's quite enjoyable, quite readable. But if you were to go back and have a look at some of the stuff that he was doing in the 80s and 90s, say, where the prose just sparkled when he talked about particular characters, and he was able to succinctly sort of cut to the chase about what a particular character's main point was by just one or two sentences, and you'd had it, and you'd go, oh, right, I know them completely. He seems to have lost that a little bit. Well, I mean, he's in his 70s now, and he's written, I don't know, 50, 60 novels or something. This is an entertainment that is quite worthwhile. It's better. I haven't read Joyland, but I did read The Colorado Kid, and I was disappointed in that one. I don't think he handled that one terribly well at the end. This one is better than that. Things are tied off at the end, and he could actually use this character of Jamie again later on, because he's the single person, first person narrator. He's basically telling the story from a position of when he's 22, and he's looking back on this from a few years previously when he's in late high school. So interesting stuff, but not one of the top lines of King's work. I gave it 3.2 out of 5.
Okay, fair enough. All right, now for my last novel, Perry and I have both read this recently, and we're both going to talk about it, but I'll start off. I think that was the agreement. Then I'll throw it back to Perry, and we can talk about the book together. So this is the latest novel by one of our favourite crime and thriller writers, the Australian author Candice Fox, whose work we've talked about several times on the podcast. And now, like her previous novel, Gathering Dark, this one, The Chase, is set in the United States. It starts outside a privately run prison in the Nevada desert, where a busload of the relatives of the prison guards and other staff are coming along to an annual baseball match between guards and prisoners. Sort of social event. But before the bus reaches the gates of the prison, the driver is shot dead by a sniper, and the warden of the prison gets a telephone call. Let all the prisoners out, or everyone on the bus will be killed. Now, despite the efforts of the warden and some of the guards to prevent it, it doesn't take long for those guards who've got children, wives or husbands on the bus to open the doors of the cells and the gates of the prison itself, and more than 600 prisoners, including some of the most violent, start running in every direction. Now, the FBI and the police are certain that the mass release has been organised in order to gain the freedom of one particular prisoner, while at the same time concealing exactly which one that was. And also, this mass release has been organised to keep the authorities fully occupied, hunting down all these hundreds of escapees. Eventually, the authorities determine the key prisoner for whom the release was organised to be one Burke David Schmitz, the leader of a white supremacist group who's been imprisoned for organising a terrorist attack. So finding Schmitz and preventing him from organising his next deadly incident becomes their focus. The rest of the book concentrates on two main characters and the ongoing issues between them. And the first of these is Celine Osborne, who's a guard captain in charge of death row prisoners at the jail, and a prisoner called John Cradle, who was sentenced to be executed for the murder of his wife, her sister, and his teenage son, and subsequently burning down the family home. Now, During his entire stay on death row, Cradle and Osborne have had a bitter ongoing feud between them. The feud doesn't involve violence as such, but it's a matter of each of them trying to annoy and inconvenience the other as much as possible in the circumstances. And Celine Osborne hates Cradle, not just because of this, but she hates him for what he's done. And she considers him to be highly dangerous. So when he, along with all the other prisoners, runs free, Osborne tries to push the authorities to concentrate on Cradle's recapture as a priority. In fact, while she's being interviewed by the media, she names Cradle as one of the biggest threats, perhaps even the biggest threats among the escapees. Now, there is, of course, a backstory to each of these characters which explains their current situation and the antagonism between them. I don't think I'm giving much away to say that John Cradle is, in fact, innocent of the terrible crime of which he's been convicted. Now that he's free, Cradle's determined to try to prove his innocence. And this, of course, is no easy task, and it's complicated by the fact that in his flight, Cradle is unwillingly forced into association with another death row prisoner who escaped at the same time, someone called Homer Carrington, who is genuinely a really scary homicidal psychopath. Meanwhile, Celine Osborne is equally determined to track down Cradle and have him put back on death row, despite the fact that she's not a police officer, just a guard employed by the company running the prison. She sets out to locate Cradle herself. To do this, she recruits the help of Walter Keeps. Now, not all of the prisoners actually left the prison during the escape. And why was that? Well, some of them were just due to be released, and Walter Keeps is one of those who was due to be released the next day, so he wasn't going to walk out the gates and risk being put back in jail for escaping. So he stayed in the prison. So Celine Osborne hooks up with him and tries to get him to help her. So Keeps has been in jail, not for violent things, but for various fraud offences. Nevertheless, Celine is certain that she can tell good men from bad men. And Keeps, she decides, is basically a good man. And John Cradle, of course, is a very bad man in her eyes. Again, it's probably not too much of a giveaway to say that it turns out that she's not at all good at assessing people. So, as usual, Candice Fox does a great job of keeping up the tension on these several intertwined storylines, not only those of Celine Osborne and John Cradle, but also the search for the domestic terrorist, Burke David Smits, and his plans to commit another atrocity, with the aim of instigating a widespread war between black and white Americans. And so there's a lot of tension in that. And there are several clever plot twists along the way. Highly recommended. What did you think of it, Perry?
I really enjoyed this. It was good to see the author working on a much wider canvas than she has in the past. Generally, it's been, you know, one or two story threads that have been around a particular small location, like a small country town. Here she's dealing with things in a lot, much wider spread across different states, across the US, across deserts. And she has some quirky little things in this as well. There's one particular little storyline which I quite like, which is it follows a serial killer who gets out.
Oh, yes.
And he thinks, oh, I'll just walk over to that tree and see how it keeps. And he just keeps on going. And nobody seems to bother him very much. He just keeps on moving from one place to the next. And he stops somewhere and he's standing by the side of the road and a combi van turns up with a whole lot of young kids in it and says, oh, would you like a lift? Oh, yeah, okay. Next thing you know, he's the only one that's getting out of the combi van.
Yes,
and he meets somebody else.
It's subtle, isn't it? It's all behind the scenes.
Beautifully done.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you just get this bit just sort of dropped in. It's like a running gag.
Yeah.
You have to have a really black sense of humour to be able to like this, and I quite liked it. I mean, you don't get any details of crimes at all, which is, I think, really well done.
Yes.
He just gets into the van, and that's it. They drive off. That's the end of that chapter. Next thing you know, there's nobody else around in the van other than him.
Yeah,
and you think, oh, okay. And then it just keeps on going. It keeps on going. And he meets a couple of German tourists and starts talking to them in German.
And the next thing you know, he's got their passport. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, then next thing you know, he's got their passport. I thought she did very well with this. It's very cinematic almost in its styling. And you could... I would not be at all surprised if there's somebody circling around this one to basically try and make a film out of it.
The two main
characters, the one, the FBI agent, who name I've forgotten, but I don't know whether you
remember. Trinity something?
Trinity somebody. Mm. She's really very, very strong.
Mm.
In fact, real hard ass
Oh,
all along
yeah,
the
she's
line.
good.
And Celine Osborne is also an interesting character because she comes to the realization through this particular novel that she thought she was very good at what she does, and then she finds out that maybe she's not quite as good as she thought,
Oh,
as she
that's right.
said, and she doesn't read people the way that she thought she did, and maybe she was on completely and utterly the wrong track with John Cradle. There's some very good pieces in here for character acting. I can see that. I can see this would make a very excellent thriller film, and I would not be at all surprised if somebody is already purchased the rights to this and is working on it. And I really would like to see how this goes. I think it would be come across really well.
It
I
would, yeah.
was pretty impressed with this. Oh, because it's sort of a bit diffuse and not quite as tight as some of the other ones in the Crimson Lake series and so on. I gave this one 3.8, but that's this is one of those ones that every time I think more about it, I kept thinking, oh, maybe I should bump that up a little bit higher. But no, I'll stay at the 3.8. I thought certainly rounded out to 4 out of 5. I thought it was a very enjoyable read. Anybody buying this book and reading this is not going to be disappointed with what they get. They are not going to get a lot of blood, guts, and gore. People die in it, but it's not massively.
There's not a focus on
No, there's not a focus on it. I mean,
No.
there is some black humour in this, but you have to like that sort of thing. If you don't like the idea of serial killers just going along doing their work in the background in an amusing manner, well, then maybe you're not going to like part of it. But I did. So, no, I thought I enjoyed it.
I probably rate it higher than that, but I don't go to the decimal point level that you do. So
Well, so you'd probably give it a 4, wouldn't you?
I'd certainly give it a 4, and if pushed, I'd probably give it a 5. But it's I enjoyed it.
She's certainly an author that's worthwhile watching, and it's interesting to see her emphasis and style and canvas, size of the canvas starting to change over time, getting bigger and bigger. I listened to an interview with her recently, and I think that she said that she's got another one in the Crimson Lake series
Oh,
coming up,
great. That's good news.
which would be really excellent.
Yeah.
But she really liked writing about the FBI agent Trinity and Selena Osborne. And that comes across very strongly in this particular book. And having good, strong female lead characters is,
Oh, it's a good, very
it
good
is
thing.
good. Yeah, it works well.
Oh, it's so interesting. Yeah. All right, I think that's probably us for the episode, Perry.
Yes, not quite as long as some of the other ones that we've
No,
done,
that's all
but I think
right.
that's all we need to do. Next time, David, I think we're just going to go back to not a specific topic, but just what it is that we've been reading lately, what we've been catching up on.
Yes, it'd be interesting to know what I'm going to read over the next couple of weeks. They all fit into that category. So it could be some very diverse things, actually.
Well, that's okay.
We'll
It
see. We'll
happened.
see.
Reading diverse things is good. As I've said before, you can't read all on the same topic and all on the same genre all the
Oh,
time.
no.
You have to move around a bit to get different viewpoints and to have different things that for to look at. Treat your reading like food. As I've said previously, you don't want to eat pizza every day, and you don't want to eat a Wagyu steak every single day either. You have to every now and again you want a salad, and sometimes you want a pasta, and sometimes all you just want is ice cream.
Yep, exactly right.
That works. All right, David.
All right,
I think we're done.
I think we're done.
All right,
So
thanks very
see
much.
you
See
in
you again
another
next
couple of
time.
weeks. Yeah, okay. Ciao.
Bye.